Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And the big news for me is I'm now a proud father of a kid with a messed up name.
Right. I was waiting for the rest of it. Yeah. And how did he get this messed up name?
Yeah. And I should have known. And, you know, for people that don't know, Japanese people don't have middle names. So they don't have that system. So it becomes difficult for one of the parents comes from a culture that has middle names and they want that included, then it's an issue. So on the birth certificate, it has only his family name and his first name or his given name. And we went to the city office and we filled it out. And the form, of course, there's no space for a middle name.
Mm, right.
So we have to write in special, like above it. And the middle name will be this. Of course, well, what is the middle name?
Right. Why do you want this thing?
Yeah. And then I pointed to my name, which is also on the form. Like, look, see how I have a middle name. And it happens to be the same. And I gave him, he was going to share my middle name. And they're like, okay. Seemed to indicate that got it. And said, okay, we can include that. And then wrote it down and wrote it in reverse. So like the middle name first and the first name second. So we got that fixed. I'm like, oh, good thing we caught that.
Yep.
And then then they showed us, okay, it's going to look like this. I'm like, okay, there's no space between the first name and the middle name. And they're like, oh, well, no problem. Look how we wrote the father's name, my name. And there's no space between my first name and middle name. So I thought, okay, so just for now, or just on this form, they've just kind of run them together. But it should be okay because my son's first name is a Chinese character, a kanji, and the middle name is a katakana, which is a
foreigner language.
Yeah, when they write loan words, they often use this katakana. And with people who are familiar with reading Japanese, they don't put spaces between the words because the different characters, as well as the different types of symbols that they use, so like they might have kanji and katakana and another style called hiragana. So it helps for the Japanese eye, it helps break up the sentences.
Right.
So they can see the individual words. So I looked at it and went, okay, so because we've got the two different styles going on there, so a Japanese person's going to look at that and go, hey, first name, middle name, easy. Then we started getting other documents from a different city office, long story. Yes. And I'm looking at they keep running them together, and I'm like, I'm wondering if this is actually a problem. Maybe we should check before we get more documents. And I was getting these documents so to sign them up for insurance, health insurance. I said, well, before we get them a health insurance card, which is even more like embedded into the system, let's check that they actually understand that his first name is not a combination of the middle name and the first name. And no, what they've done, they were like, yeah, whatever, if you want to mash these two names up together, we'll do that for you.
Oh, that's you wacky foreigner.
So my son now has the equivalent of Billy Bob.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So now so even though the boy is less than 2 weeks old, he has to officially change his name back to the name it was on his birth certificate.
Right, because he's already had that and it's already in the system and they said, no, we can't change it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it'll take 2 months to do that.
Right. Four times as long as he's been alive, as you pointed out.
Yeah, four times as long as he's been alive and like eight times as long as he's had this messed up name.
Right.
So you kind of want to say to them, it's like, well, if I'm 10 years old and I want to change my name, are you going to go, okay, when you're 80, you'll have this new name because it's going to take that long. This might be interesting. When my father-in-law went to the courthouse to ask about the name change, how long it would take, and they said 2 months, one of the reasons they cited for it taking so long was that so many people are getting their names changed.
They didn't say to what, which is unfortunate because I'm really curious about what they're getting their name changed to and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, me too. I think if I had to guess, I would say they are choosing names that are less common.
Or do you think, because it's something we don't have to deal with in Western language, but I wonder if they are changing their names just to change their kanji, their Chinese character. Because I imagine if you wanted to do that legally, it would be the same as changing your name in a Western country, you know, and having to go through the legal channels of doing so.
Oh, you mean it reads the same way, but it's a different character?
Yeah, I imagine you would have to do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, one thing that's important when they pick the names, and we had to go through that, even though my son has my last name, so it's done in that katakana style, but there's still a number of strokes to my name. But what they do is they look at the two names together and they count the number of strokes in total, and that will determine the how lucky the kid will be in the future.
Oh, really? So it's first and last name?
Yes.
It's
the combination, yeah.
Okay. I thought it was just first name, yeah.
So the original Chinese characters, the original kanji that we had chosen for my son's first name or given name, turned out to be unlucky and he would have a terrible life. Right. And all we needed to do is, you know, my wife tells me this or sends me a text and I'm like, oh damn, because we were kind of really looking forward to having that name and we really like that first Chinese character, which means gallant. Oh, what are we going to do? And she's like, oh, no problem. We just changed the second one. And I'm like, okay, well, you could have just put that in the original text too.
Instead of letting me sweat about it.
Yeah. But then changing that one Chinese character meant he's going to be very lucky. Well, so far, not so lucky.
Right. Yeah. No, but the not having the middle name thing was kind of interesting because we were watching a TV show here and one of the talents is American and was explaining how the more names that got used when your parents called you for something, the more trouble you were in. You know, first they start with the pet name, then they go to the full name, then it's the full name and the last name, and finally it's all of your names, you know, middle name included. Then you know you're in big trouble.
Right.
And my wife turns to me and said, is that true? I'm like, yeah, that's totally how it works. And she thought that was fascinating because without middle names, they don't really, that's something that doesn't happen here, you know?
Maybe they drop the Kun or the Chan.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure there are other ways to indicate that you are in deep trouble with your parents, but yeah, it's not using all of your names.
Yeah. So one thing that they do when they talk to, it's a term of endearment. They'll add Kun to the end of a boy's name or a man's name and Chan at the end of a girl's name, a woman's name, or just a child in general. The Chan can also be used for boys. So that's what my wife does when she refers to my son. And she says his name plus Kun or Chan. And I don't. I just say his name.
Right.
And apparently we've been saying it illegally.
Illegally. The Japanese name police. Yeah, the Japanese name police are going to bang down your door pretty soon.
You're not saying half his name. No. But other than that, everything's going really well with my son. So I'm very happy.
Good.
And he doesn't know. He's.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it'll be a couple years before he figures it out.
Hold on, I feel that I was called something else for the first 2 months of my life. find this document. Who is this?
My long lost twin brother.
Yes, you actually joined together. So we've joined your names together, and we lost them when we separated.
Right, where did he go? I don't know. There's a space between you.
Yeah, you see that tiny scar there?
Oh, that would be so rude.
Big news in the gaming world. I think we're kind of late to the party here, but Indiana's bill, which is now going to be amended to include language about or preventing discrimination against gays, lesbians, and transgenders, I believe.
Right, and the big news in gaming is that Gen Con might move.
Oh, yeah, I didn't make that connection at all.
No, you didn't make that connection,
people were like,
yeah.
Oh, I guess Indiana, people were like, oh,
yeah, you're like, gaming news? Yeah. No. Yeah. I don't think that's been resolved yet. You know,
it's been announced that they'll be including an amendment with that kind of language, but it hasn't happened yet.
Oh, I meant the Gen Con thing. Like, I don't know if it's been resolved.
Oh, okay, we're back to Gen Con. Okay.
Sorry. This being a gaming podcast, I assumed the focus of the story was mostly on how it affected gaming, but okay. But,
well, they had the five-year contract, or a contract for the next 5 years until 2020 is what I've heard.
Right. I heard that too.
And we were talking about it prior to the podcast and saying we don't know what clauses are in the contract, but unless they have like a morality clause or something that allows them to get out of it, they would pretty much have to have some sort of incident happen at Gen Con for them to break the contract. And right. I think that Indianapolis, I think the businesses and the people are going to fall all over themselves to welcome the Gen Con
attendees,
participants. Yeah. Attendees.
Plus, even if there's like a 5 year, 5 years left in the contract, I imagine it would take maybe not if all of that, at least the majority of that, to move a convention as big as Gen Con to another location.
Take at least a year.
Yeah, I mean, well, okay, five might be a bit of a stretch because it's not exactly like the Olympics or anything. But yeah, it's not like they could. I don't think they could just like move it overnight, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cities with pretty decent convention facilities. I suppose it would just matter if there was another major convention around at that time. And I'm going to guess that Gen Con's been pretty savvy about when they schedule it, that they haven't scheduled it where it would conflict with any other, at least geek or gaming comic books, science fiction kind of conventions, major ones.
Well, I tend to think that Gen Con is big enough to the point where other cons are the ones that have to worry about scheduling around Gen Con rather than.
This is true. That's a good point. Yeah. So unless there's like a bunch of mass monster truck conventions, why did I say monster trucks? Because those are rallies. They're clearly not conventions. People don't go to a convention of monster trucks. And
I'm gonna go to a monster truck convention.
Yeah, they'll go to the middle of the city and just talk about monster trucks and maybe
look at
watch
pictures.
Them
yeah, some yeah, videos. Yeah,
trade them. Dress up as their favorite monster truck drivers.
I thought you were gonna say dress up as their favorite monster truck.
Oh, they could do that, or what's that Robosaurus?
Oh yeah.
Watch Robosaurus. I don't know what it's actually called, but it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex that eats cars.
I'm sure there's more than one. Now I'm imagining everybody at that convention has to talk in that, like, Sunday, Sunday, Sunday. We're going to the monster truck rally, rally, rally.
And after, yeah. Come to the monster truck convention.
Oh, man, that would get so annoying. Like, I annoyed myself just with that little bit.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't seen one of those commercials in, I'm going to say easily, a decade, maybe two decades.
Well, it's also because we're over here, and those things just don't happen over here.
No, but it just sticks in your head. So obviously they did a very good job that Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
They did. They did.
Watch Truckosaurus eat, blah, blah,
yeah.
blah.
Yeah, eat a bunch of cars, yeah.
Bigfoot 2, watch it crash trucks.
Maybe cars. Break its axle and do nothing.
Yeah, but I think that there's some casualties. Or this issue has seen its first casualties, and those casualties are gay couples who would like to cater their weddings with pizza.
Right.
A step up from McDonald's, because a pizzeria called, I think, Memories Pizza or something.
Right, right.
Has said that they would not serve pizza to gay couples getting married or something.
Right. No, yeah. I think
or they wouldn't cater a gay wedding.
Right, they were the first kind of business to come out in favor of it. And yeah, a bit of a tangent, like I've seen McDonald's-sponsored weddings. And
oh, you have?
Yeah, like there was a program here about it. But for some reason they were in China, right? And people went over and then saw this thing, and it looked pretty ridiculous. But hey,
Were the bride and groom a little bit heavier?
They were not, actually, but I think they were stand-ins. I think it was staged. You know, like, this is what you could have.
Oh, I see.
Rather than this is an actual one that has happened.
So they didn't look like they had diabetes or...
No, they did not look like they ate McDonald's frequently. Yeah.
Yeah. What you're
getting. But, yeah. No, honestly, having pizza, catered pizza, doesn't sound all that bad because you would save money.
All right, but you didn't tune in to hear about my son or monster truck conventions and rallies. You tuned in to hear what 5 games you need on your shelf. So Wayne and I were talking about like great moments in gaming history and the key games that everybody needs to play. And we thought about making a list of 5 games that everybody needs to have or to try. And we're not saying that these are the 5 best games or even our 5 favorite games, but these are just 5 must-have games.
Right. Because some of my favorite games didn't make the list. As well said, these are just games that we think everyone should play or should, you know, run. Or maybe just participate in is a better way to say it.
Right. And why do we think that? And we came up with a list of criteria. And one is place in history. So a game has a place in gaming history.
One of the other criteria was that it is a good example or exemplifies a particular style of game.
Yep. So in our list, we try not to overlap on those styles. Another criterion is that it's innovative. So did it do something or did it add something to game mechanics or game settings and just gaming in general?
One of the other criteria is recognition. Not so much how many people play these games, how many people play this particular game, but more of like how many people have heard of this game or I guess how well known it is in kind of the gaming popular culture.
Mm-hmm. Like, is it a part of the gaming lexicon? Has it added to the vocabulary?
Right. So if you mention this game, will people go, huh, what? Or will they go, oh yeah, that's right, I've heard of that.
Yeah. So having this game is going to make you is going to expand your gaming vocabulary in a sense. And one criterion that we actually rejected was we originally thought to put that it has to be in print, but then we realized with people making games available through, I suppose, legal channels, but it's a little bit gray. So we decided that it doesn't matter if it's in print or out of print. It's still eligible to be on your shelf. I mean, you can still go to like a secondhand bookstore and pick up a copy or something.
Right. No, I'm not going to say there are only a few games that are out of print, but like it is possible to get games, and it's possible to get out of print games like through legal channels, either as, you know, PDF or things, and then with the, you know, prevalence now of print on demand, you know, you can just still have this book on your shelf.
Oh, absolutely. And some game companies, like like Wizards of the Coast to make all the editions of D&D available.
Right.
So you can't say any of those are out of print. We originally thought that West End Star Wars would classify as out of print. And I suppose technically it is, but you can get a revised version called Re-Up online.
Yes.
And I suppose that is somewhat legal, but it's certainly available.
Right, right. It's not like you have to go to the dark internet to get it.
Yeah, what would that be, like the Silk Road?
Oh, I remember.
Yeah,
I
was I'll get some heroin and...
Star Wars West End game. Yeah.
And how much for the DC heroes? And one more thing is the games don't necessarily have to meet all of these criteria. These are things that were just factored into our choice.
Right.
All right. Now, the first game, we might as well just get it out of the way because everybody knows it's going to be on the list, and that is Dungeons & Dragons.
Right, right. I think
which edition?
There was a bit of a contention between us in terms of, which edition made it, and...
Was the contention is that you were like, any edition, whatever, it's all together, it's all the same.
Yeah, because...
And I said, we would get crucified if we said...
Right, right, and I
we
do...
We have to commit to an edition.
I do see your point. I actually kind of broadened it out, and I said, any version of D&D or Pathfinder, because... From my perspective and based on these criteria, I kind of looked at it as that's the class and level, that's the D20, that's the let's go into the dungeon and kill monsters and take their stuff, let's play heroes kind of game. So both kind of, not both, but mechanically, style-wise, they're all very similar enough to the point where I said they're close enough to be the same thing.
Right. But in an effort to avoid hate mail, we decided to commit to an edition. Wait, actually, that might not avoid hate
mail. Yeah, exactly. No mail. Yeah. And actually, no mail is bad mail.
Yeah. But we've chosen 5th edition. And the reason is it's just because it's the most recent edition. And when we look at the criteria of whether how widespread it is, usually the most current edition is the one that people are going to play more.
Right.
And have more ready access. And D&D is it's the original gateway game because it spawned this hobby and brought people into the hobby, but it also still does that.
Mm.
And you talk to, I would say, most people who play role-playing games, and they could have started in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and Dungeons & Dragons, I mean, there might have been that period in the early 90s where Vampire might have been the one that introduced them to role-playing, but Dungeons & Dragons tends to be the one that brings them in.
Well, also, speaking of widespread, I mean, even outside of gaming spheres, usually when people say, oh, I want to play a role-playing game, they don't actually say, I want to play a role-playing game. They say, I want to play D&D, because D&D is kind of the stand-in word for role-playing game for people outside of the geek cultures. I mean, to the point where people who are trying to explain the game to someone who doesn't play, you can just say, it's like D&D, and they will at least have some idea of what that entails. You know? Whereas you've said it's Vampire or it's, Fate or Hollow Earth Expedition or whatever, they'd be like, huh, what?
Yeah.
So, but, no, I also didn't think about this before the podcast, but with the recent edition of, or the most recent edition of D&D 5th edition, I mean, the basic rules are free. So it is very widely accessible, even probably more accessible than before, because you don't even really have to buy anything to get started with the game.
This is true.
Legally. How about that?
Yeah, legally. Yeah. And it's the one edition to rule them all in a sense, in that they tried to poach from the different editions to create the one that will please as many people as they can. And the feedback has been really positive.
Yep.
There seems to be some holdouts, and certainly people are pretty loyal to Pathfinder, which is pretty much 3.5.
Hate mail. We're going to hate mail.
But yeah, 5th edition seems to get a lot of, our online, the places we go, seems to get a lot of positive feedback. And it is a decent game. And it's, I would say, easier to get into than, let's say, 3.5. Not saying it's a better game than 3.5, but it's easier to grasp.
It's more beginner-friendly.
More beginner-friendly. Easier to make a character.
Yeah, I'd originally wanted to put, like, Dungeons & Dragons 3.5, or I guess 3.x, and Pathfinder on the list because, kind of getting back to the style of game, that version of the game and the, Dungeons & Dragons 3.75, meaning Pathfinder, really, to me, kind of epitomize the D20 era and style and mechanics of games. Where, 5th edition takes from that and is still very much a D20 game, but it's kind of, in addition to trying to take the best of from previous D&D editions, 5th edition also seems like it's trying to take from other styles of games, because gaming kind of, at least in some areas, has moved on from what D&D, at least the D20 version, used to be. And it's not to the sense that other games have, but it's tried to become a bit more narrative, 5th edition. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that as not being D&D anymore, but being a little bit different from kind of the, you know, what 3.5 and Pathfinder was.
That's an interesting point. You know, arguing that 3.x is a pure version of D&D, in a sense. It's not exactly what you're
right,
saying.
Right, right. In the sense of that style of game, then then yes, it being a pure version is, I guess, a better way to say it.
And the D20 revolution that followed 3rd edition certainly gives it a decent place in history.
Right.
Perhaps more than 4th or 2nd. But yeah, it's still 5th edition. I'm not going to say the 5th edition has a bigger place in history than the other editions, but I might argue that 3rd might have a bigger one, the second biggest next to 1st.
Okay.
But just because it's the most recent and the one that's going to be
talked about,
the one that's most likely played at your local gaming store that you would walk in, I just think of all the games, that's D&D's thing. It's the game that most people play.
Right.
So play the one that most of those people play.
Mm. Yeah. No, I completely agree. I wonder, because, I definitely agree that 3rd edition has a large place in history because of the D20 kind of revolution era it spawned.
Yeah.
And, yeah, okay, I would probably put original D&D as the second, but, well, okay, fair enough, the first biggest, since it kind of started the whole role-playing thing. But
yeah, maybe, yeah.
Fourth, yeah, exactly. But 4th edition kind of has a nefarious place in that it created Pathfinder and caused the first massive, or at least massively public, split between editions.
I think all the editions have a big place in history. I mean, it's D&D.
Right.
2nd edition kicked off a wave of settings.
Splat books, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And 4th edition, yeah, you could say it's a somewhat infamous, or your word, nefarious. But with it also came things like more online content, a different style, a different approach where they really tried to make the game accessible to beginners and tried to really shape the way the information is presented. And people said that, yeah, they borrowed a lot from, let's say, World of Warcraft or other things like that. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the actual way the book is presented and laid out.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I think that is another significant, I guess, advancement or significant milestone. So, yeah, and yeah, you're absolutely correct. They also spawned its biggest competitor in Pathfinder. But more competition is good, I guess. It gives consumers more options and forces the companies to improve and offer a really good product. So
That's true.
Yeah.
So for all these reasons, Dungeons & Dragons deserves a place on your shelf. And
yes.
We didn't even mention playing it.
Yeah. We originally had fun to play as a criterion, but decided against including that. Because
we like to play unfun games.
Yeah, I guess some of these are pretty joyless. Of course, Dungeons & Dragons is as good as you think it is going to be. It's a good game. You can't knock the game.
Well, you can, you just can't be right about it.
But the reason why it should be on your shelf is more than just how fun it is at the table.
Right, right.
Because we're not talking about the 5 games you need on your table. We're just talking about the ones on the shelf to look at.
Yeah, to look at and say, I'm glad I have these games that I never play.
So Attractive Spines should have been one of the criteria.
Spine Visibility, yeah.
And what would you put forth as the second book to put on our shelf?
So I would put Vampire as the second.
Okay. I would agree with Vampire. What edition? Old World of Darkness? Vampire the Masquerade? Vampire the Requiem? Or they're calling it Vampire Requiem second edition now?
Right, right. The yes. God Machine Chronicles update.
Yeah.
Right.
But my book says Strix Chronicles.
So does mine, because we got it at the same time. Right, right. Back before they made the change. I would go with Vampire the Requiem, which I know is going to be kind of contentious.
Well, okay, why would you say... I'm going to disagree.
I know you are. Yep.
But why would you say Vampire the Requiem?
Because I think... I guess a big part of that is because it cleaned up a lot of the mechanics. Maybe not cleaned up, but streamlined and made them, I think, more unified and therefore more accessible. And, you know, it even going into like the New World of Darkness, it kind of made a line out of all the different supernatural lines, right? So what? Maybe it's not fair, but when I'm saying Vampire the Requiem, I'm kind of extending that to all of the New World of Darkness line, but Vampire in particular, where all of these books now work together and they use the same system, slightly modified in certain cases, but yeah, I think the accessibility and kind of cleaned up nature of Requiem is important.
Well, I agree. It did clean up the rules. I think it's a better game. I prefer New World of Darkness over Old World of Darkness in how it plays.
But
I would say, but a game is more than mechanics. And I love New World of Darkness mechanics. I love the way it's presented, particularly when Requiem first came out, when they had a New World of Darkness has its own book. And we've said it past episodes. I'm a real big fan of that choice because it got me thinking about running games using only the World of Darkness book. And I guess they've gone Machine Chronicles now.
Well, I mean, they had the regular World of Darkness book, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like I said, a game is more than its mechanics. And there's just something about Vampire the Masquerade's mythology and setting that really draws you in. It's, in a way, it's more accessible, but it's also deeper. It's really hard for me to separate Vampire the Masquerade's place in history from this decision. And just, it didn't make a splash. It made a crater, what it did. I mean, it just kind of changed gaming when it came in. And a superior game came out later. It was superior system, superior mechanics, and maybe even better planning. And it may be made a little bit of a splash, and that's Requiem.
Mm.
But yeah, even if you're going to use the New World of Darkness mechanics to play the Old World of Darkness, I mean...
But you can.
Yeah, and you can absolutely do that. I mean, it just sucks you in. It's really hard for me to articulate, which is probably a bad quality to have in a podcast host. But you open that book, and just it really sucked you into that mythology. And the decision to make Requiem a little bit more open or a little bit more up to the storyteller and the players on, hey, what are these vampires really about? I guess I can respect that decision, but they do make that sacrifice. Is they're not sucking them into a real hard set world.
No, that's true. The open nature of Requiem means that you kind of can't have that mythology because, like, all of the five, I guess, kind of clans that made it into Requiem have different kind of origin stories. And, well, it's one of those things you have to say all of them are true. Because if only one of them was true, and eventually, they'd find out since vampires live forever, But yeah, so you're right. You do kind of lose that mythology by opening it up.
All right. So Vampire has made the shelf. Is it red or is it green is the choice. But all right, well, moving along. I mean, I guess we did need Chris to break that tie. So Vampire's made it, but whether or not it's old or new, I guess you decide. We'll see if we come back later on that. For the third one, I'm going to put forth... even though Chris used to say I didn't like this game, even though I never said that, but it's not my favorite game, but I do appreciate its style and what it and how it represents its style. I also appreciate how it's been embraced by the gaming community and what it spawned. A lot of people are adding different settings and that is Fate.
Oh.
Man, are you thinking Savage Worlds?
Yes, the way you were hyping it up and talking, I'm like, oh man, he's going to say Savage Worlds, isn't he? Sheesh. But, okay.
I see some overlap between Fate and Savage Worlds in the community aspect, and it spawned all of those things. But I'm also thinking that Fate also brings with it a certain narrative style with the aspects, which I think is a good example of narrative mechanics, which a lot of games that came out around that time or after it also started to do.
Right. No, I agree. Yeah. I agree. No, I was going to say, I see some overlap between Fate and Savage Worlds in terms of the mechanics, because both kind of have that either Fate points or bennies, where, mm-hmm. okay, you don't earn them the same way, but they kind of do the same thing, and they encourage role-playing and player involvement and effect on the narrative in similar ways. But, yeah, I can also see a lot of similarity in the community sense as well, in terms of, yeah, both of them have, both of them have spawned a lot of, settings or either official or fan-created supplements, rules, and all the stuff. And yeah, the community seems to be very passionate about the respective games. But yes, I agree that Fate is doing something different from Savage Worlds, and it kind of is a better example of the more narrative style of games that we've been seeing, or I guess a lot of recently. So yeah, I definitely agree that Fate is on the list of games that you should have on your shelf.
You know, Fate is on the list just because it overlaps with so many other games for different reasons. It touches different styles or different aspects of different games. And, you know, you're talking about the crossover Savage Worlds. Of course, like the Powered by Apocalypse games, they have the community, and that's a narrative style game. Also look at Fate as being a universal system. So you're looking at it crossing over with games like GURPS, Hero System.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. In a different sense. I mean, like, I've seen people put up like blog posts and whatever, or people who have worked on the Fate, you know, game in a professional sense saying, yep, okay, Fate can do a lot of things and a lot of genres. There are some things it doesn't do, and there are some things you kind of shouldn't try and make it do. And one of those is, like, in the beginning of the book, they say Fate characters and stories about Fate characters, they need to be proactive and fairly capable. So it kind of seems like Fate would not do something like Call of Cthulhu well, when the protagonists are meant to be kind of, not incapable, but up against kind of unsurmountable odds, where something like, I think, GURPS or the Hero System maybe could do that. So, I mean, there certainly are many things that Fate could do, but it's always kind of, whatever game you're going to play is wrapped around and focused on these very capable protagonists.
And basic role-playing does Call of Cthulhu pretty well.
Right, right. I'm sure it does, yeah.
Yeah. No, that is a good point. And yeah, a little bit of a tangent here, but I think all universal systems have areas which they struggle to accommodate. I know, like GURPS, you could make any superhero you want in the world, but certainly if you try to make a brick with the GURPS system, it's going to be tough.
Well, isn't it you can make any superhero in the world? It's just going to maybe take you forever to do so.
Yeah, if you've got the
rules you have to go through. Yeah.
If you've got the time, the energy. It's the man who tried to make the X-Men.
right.
Yeah.
How long before you gave up?
Two characters.
And how long did that take you?
A long time.
Okay. And you gave up because you were weak, not enough Mountain Dew to keep you going.
Well, the thing with GURPS, kind of a GURPS tangent here, is because you can do everything, you kind of feel like you have to have everything on the paper.
Right, that's a very good
point.
Whereas
other game systems are much more open, so you're like, yeah, okay, I got energy beams, and if I think of something that they can do, I'll do it as the game plays. But with GURPS, you're like, hey, you want it to ricochet? You can do that.
Because here's the ricochet rules.
Yeah, you want it to fire underwater? Go for it. You can do that. Here's how much it costs.
Here's the cost modifier to have it fire underwater. No, that's a good point. I think, yeah, some game systems, and bring it back to Fate, some game systems, I guess, kind of hand wave that, or say you have it already and you don't really have to worry about it, where, you know, GURPS, you have to pay for it and you have to build it in. Where I think Fate is a little bit similar, though, in that you do have to build it in, just not in numbers and kind of traditional mechanics. It's you have to build it into that package of an aspect.
Yeah.
Or a stunt or a skill, possibly. Like, it still has to be there, just not in a sense maybe gamers are more used to.
Yeah, absolutely. But, and another strength of Fate is that those aspects represent that. And as long as it feels right. Yeah, and somebody who watches movies or TV series and they go, like, yeah, this person does that and they're capable of doing these things and they do them. And even when they have surprises, it goes, yeah, no, but that feels in character. I could see that person doing that.
Right, or that's kind of a logical extension of that power. And we've never seen them do that thing before, but given what we've seen them do in the past, it's not out of character, or it's not beyond the kind of the internal laws of physics of this genre for them to be able to do it. And Fate does do that pretty well. Yeah.
Yeah, a good comic book writer makes the characters that have been around since like the 30s, 40s, 60s, and makes them do something different with their powers. And people go, yeah, wow, that's really creative. Yeah. And I probably prefer, again, a similar thing or something that Fate crosses over with is like Cortex. I would say I prefer Cortex, or I play Cortex more.
Right.
And those style games. But and it gets into like my argument with our contentious number two is Fate really like hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Cortex makes making a splash, and certainly coming up with that hacker's guide really helps, you know, push it forward and showing the people the possibilities of that system.
Yes, yes.
But Fate, you know, just it's a big player.
Yeah, no, I coming up with the list of my list of five, you know, before we kind of combined them, I considered putting Cortex Plus on the list, but my feeling was I kind of couldn't justify it because even though, yeah, I too am more familiar with Cortex and maybe even preferred a little bit more to Fate, as you said you do, Fate is just kind of seems bigger and kind of, I don't know, kind of hate to say it seems a bit more innovative, but
I wouldn't say that, but yeah.
I know, there's just something...
I really loved Marvel Heroic.
Yeah, yeah, loved Marvel Heroic, yeah.
Leverage is a lot of fun, so...
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, as you said, I think Fate just kind of hit bigger and maybe has maybe more people talking about it and kind of... There are similarities, you know, aspects are very similar to distinctions and how you use them and, you know, but yeah, I think Fate just wins.
Okay. Well, we have an agreement there. What would you put for the fourth game they have to have on the shelf?
This is going to be contentious and you're going to argue against it as other ones, but I'm going to say Monster Hearts because I think an Apocalypse World game deserves a spot on your shelf, but oddly enough, I don't think that game is Apocalypse World.
I agree with the choice. I thought, having played Apocalypse World, which is interesting, but I think it's difficult to run and play, or more difficult to run and play, sorry, than some of the other Powered by Apocalypse World games. But then Monster Hearts after, and I thought that it was a lot easier to get. It was a lot easier to get the system
right.
And these moves. And I, you know, Monster Hearts, for people who aren't familiar, is kind of like Jennifer's Body and those type of games, or Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Right.
It's pretty much supernatural high school.
Yeah, teen romance. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, teen romance, supernatural high school. And I thought that was a really nice combination of system and setting. And so while I applaud that choice of Powered by Apocalypse World games, I don't know if that system deserves to be top five essential.
Here's why I think it deserves to be top five, because both, I think whether, maybe the sound weird, whether you like the game or not, or whether you, well, hopefully you have a good time playing it if you play it, I think that both playing and running an Apocalypse World-based game kind of shows you a different way to, maybe not approach role-playing, but definitely running the game gives you a different way to kind of organize your thoughts and how to run the game, mostly because the GM or the person running the game doesn't roll dice. And I mean, normally when you kind of run a game, you know, you're rolling dice too to see what happens, and then, you know, sometimes you get that lucky hit or that miss or whatever, and, you know, you're kind of building these important characters, often like a PC, you know, with their own kind of like skills and powers, but that's not how Apocalypse World games work. Like, NPCs especially are just narrative constructs, maybe with a few numbers or powers to, you know, kind of describe what they do, but as you never roll dice, you, the game master, are pretty much kind of reacting to what the players do. And that, for me, you know, running those games was a big shift and made me realize that there are other ways to run the game or to run a game besides what I had been doing. And that's why I think an Apocalypse World-based game deserves a spot on your shelf. At least from the GM standpoint. And maybe as a player standpoint, all of those games are very much player-facing. And I guess maybe not player-empowering, but they encourage a lot of player input and collaboration, where oftentimes that is built into the system. You know, like if you're playing like another game like Dungeons & Dragons or Pathfinder or something, I mean, the game master can say, tell me about this thing your character knows, and you know, they write it down and it becomes part of the game world, and they say, great, where's your character from, or what land do they look like? But it's not really baked into the rules of the system. It's something that the players can choose to do, whereas with an Apocalypse World-based game, a lot of the moves are very kind of open to interpretation, or the moves themselves say, great, player, tell us what happens, or tell us how your character knows this, or tell us what your character knows, and the GM then has to roll with it. So maybe that's a better way to say it. I think it forces the game master to play more improv style, which I think makes any GM better, even if you then choose not to run that game anymore or move on to another system.
Yeah. I mean, you're making a good case in the sense that, yeah, it can expand how you approach a game and how you play a game, and can expand your idea of, like, the role of the game master, especially. I don't know. It still seems like a niche game to me.
Okay, fair enough. It's probably not as big as D&D, but what is, apart from maybe like Pathfinder? But with all, there's all been a lot, some people may even say like a glut of Powered by the Apocalypse games coming out recently.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have certainly bought most of them. Yeah, it seems like, and this could be like a completely unfair characterization, but I have trouble not viewing Powered by Apocalypse as Fate's little sibling.
In terms of size or mechanics or?
In terms of, it kind of fits that narrative niche, and, you know, people make their own settings based on the system and then get them out there and get them published. And it just seems like Fate the lesser. And not lesser in the terms of fun or anything like that, but just in terms of impact. Yeah. I'm not saying I wouldn't put it in the top five based on our criteria, but it just seems, yeah. I don't know. I'm wondering if there are other things.
Yeah,
out there.
I would disagree, but
yeah.
Well, obviously, which is why I suggested it. But yeah. Fair enough. And I mean, like, it does fill a similar niche as Fate does, in that you have to be. It is kind of, I guess, the framework can be kind of, in a sense, generic. Where, you know, yeah, there are all these games coming out that use this Powered by the Apocalypse engine. But I mean, it's different from something like GURPS or even Fate, because you could play pretty much anything in Fate without having to change any of the mechanics, right? All you're doing is, all you would need to do is reskin stuff, right? Kind of the same with GURPS, even though that's a bit more of a toolbox, just because of that's how GURPS works, and there you're picking what rules you use. Where for like Apocalypse World stuff, while all the games do use the same framework, the trigger for the moves that happen and the results for the move that happens are so dependent on what that particular game is about and the genre that game is about. It's a universal framework, but it's not as if there's a universal system. Like, I've seen people ask, like, great, okay, I've heard a lot about, like, Dungeon World or, you know, Monster Hearts or Monster of the Week. Where can I kind of find the system reference document for an Apocalypse World game? And the answer is there isn't one, because all of those games, while similar, are different in what they do, and they're different in how the narrative outcome, input and output of the mechanics, that you kind of can't have one. So after that long run, I guess what I'm saying is it's kind of different from Fate, in that it's kind of, you know, the universal system thing kind of applies, but really doesn't.
Well, I didn't say it was Fate's twin.
No, right.
And it came out of the womb 2 seconds after. Yeah, it's certainly different. It's certainly its own animal. So that's why I said it could be an unfair characterization, but it's hard for me to, when I'm looking at something that represents a type and a style, that it has its own. But yeah, like I said, I mean, you've certainly made a good case.
Not good enough, obviously. So what was your number four?
I mean, this was really, really tough, because I mean, there's certain things. I wanted something that represented a point by, and for that would be, I mean, there's a lot of good things out there, and this thing is, you know, I think it's even any standard we would look at is out of print, but DC Heroes was, I thought, of the point buys, was a really good essential thing. But maybe it's just because, you know, it brought me into role-playing, or brought me back into role-playing. And because it tries to do so many things, and I think it does a lot of them really well, and I might even say that it's like the Velvet Underground of role-playing games, and that maybe not a lot of people bought the original CDs, but the ones that did, they formed bands. I kind of see this game as like, maybe a lot of people enough people didn't buy it, but the ones that did, like, got really inspired to do really different things, and that's Torg.
Okay.
The Masterbook series, which Torg kind of kicked off, they have templates, and you just add points to the templates. I mean, it has so many different genres. It it's ambitious because it has like fantasy. It has kind of like
fantasy Japan.
Yeah, fantasy Japan. 80s hard on Japan.
Yeah,
you know, with the ninjas and corporations.
Yeah,
that is Japan.
And mecha too, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and the horror realm and Nile Empire. So you got your pulp. So it really offers a lot for genre wise, and you could say that's messy and it's pretty. But then it keeps adding some things, and I can see why this intimidates people. Then it's like adds the cards, the drama deck.
Mm-mm.
The drama deck. And I think that's just so innovative, and it's you roll and you look at a chart, which I suppose is not too innovative, rolling and looking at a chart, but it just uses the one die, the D20. Yeah, and it just the idea, and then you think, well, if you have a prehistoric world and you have a kind of a cyber papacy, like a kind of a cyberpunk world cross with the Vatican. They have different technology and different spirit levels, different magic levels. How do you resolve that, and how do you work with that? And they've got those rules. I don't know. I just the scope of what they try to do, it just blows me away. And I think it was before its time, in that we were talking about this, and I was mentioned about this idea of the Infiniverse, and everybody. It's like a living game, and everybody contributes to how this story is going to play out.
Right, right.
And they did through like newsletters, and yeah, I think you get mailed in the results of your game sessions. And nowadays, that would be really easy to do. You just do it online.
Absolutely.
And people do update it online, but this was done in like the early 90s and that, so.
As you were saying, yeah, you had to wait to buy the book that they printed and came.
Yeah, and then you would have to buy the Infiniverse update books, and yeah, they were proper books, but. Mm. I mean, you'd have to pay about—I forget how much. I'm going to say $20.
Right. Probably. It's also the lack of immediacy, where like you submit that game result, and you want to have it see an effect on that game world within kind of like a reasonable amount of time. And hey, as long as it took them, however long it took them to collect and then go through and then update their thing and then print the book, I'm sure that with today's technology, it would work a lot better.
Yeah. So. I think it has a place in history. People know the name and some vague concepts, but I don't think a lot of people have played it.
Mm.
And I think the system is a bit not controversial, but I think it splits people.
Why do you think so?
They thought of rules for a lot of things, but maybe they shouldn't have.
Okay.
Because again, like we said before, like with GURPS, if you think of rules for something, then it has rules, so you don't wing it.
Right, right.
Because you have the rules. And we talked about that as specialists and generalists. It's like, it's fine to wing the game, but if you're winging the game because you just can't remember the rules, then you probably should learn the rules a little bit more.
Right. Or even worse, you can't be bothered to use them because they're too complex.
Yeah.
But now it kind of sounds like Torg suffers a bit from the kind of like, maybe I'll call it like rules overload, which we might be seeing not a backlash to, but like a, kind of like a response to with all the kind of indie narrative games that are coming out. So yeah, kind of that move away from a rule for everything. I mean, even new 5th edition's Dungeons & Dragons are like rulings over rules,
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, when they talk about how to destroy like these different devices, I won't get too much into it, but... I mean, you've got the reality and these different zones, like different cosms invading other cosms. And then you got pure zones and mixed zones and dominant zones. So you're like, okay, that's
it's
a lot of different types of zones. And then different things happen to you when you're in different zones. And when you're crossing over, reality storms happen to you. And there's these laws of reality. So, I mean, if you're this doing that, then this could happen. And if you're trying to destroy this, then you've got to have these steps or this could happen.
Right. But if you're that doing that, then that thing could happen. And Yeah.
So, and it wants to have a certain style of game, a very dramatic style, very fun style. So and when you go into the different cosms, it wants you to play in a certain way. So each cosm has its own like world laws. So he goes in the Isle Empire, and they're like, we really want it to be a pulp feel, so it's going to have these three rules.
Right.
That'll affect the game and the mechanics, and then somebody's going to have to remember that. Whereas I think, like you said, more than indie games, just kind of trying to capture that in just how you play it, as opposed to the mechanics to support the play. Yeah.
No, it sounds like Torg tried to be a universal game with a single setting. And ways to kind of bounce back and forth, but still have those rules in place so that, as you said, the Nile Empire still plays like a pulp game, whereas, I don't know, like, the Realm of Horror plays kind of like a horror game.
Yeah.
As opposed to something like, I guess like Rifts, because Rifts was the thing I kind of, said it sounds most like when I first heard about it, but Riss doesn't try and explain why, and I guess it does, but it always seemed like Torg did a better job of handling those different realities with those different like world rules, saying like, no, now that you're here, this is how the game will play. And like, I guess if you wanted to, you could play Torg completely in one world and only have that kind of game. But, I mean, I'm sure they made the game so that you kind of bounce around.
Yeah, the default is you bounce around. Yeah, they wanted it to make sense. Whereas, yeah, Riffs would be like, what's the explanation? Or Riffs, it's on the title. Come on.
Right, right. Yeah, what's the explanation?
Riffs!
Yelled really loud, and then a guitar solo and an explosion in the background, yeah.
And what, you know, in a testament to Riffs, it endured a lot longer. Like, it's still around. It's got
it still endures. Mock it as you will. Riffs still endures.
Yeah. And Torg is around. Another company bought it. I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I've bought the PDFs, even though I have all the print stuff. Yeah. And then I was rereading the revised thing, and I thought the revised book's really well written and presents the rules really well. And it's a lot of rules. And of course, they have the rule like, hey, you know, don't have to remember all the rules. The best way to learn is to play.
Is that the first rule?
No, actually, it's like about 70 pages in, I think. I think at a certain point, they're like writing and like, hold on, we better put, you know.
Yep, we got to put that golden rule.
A little bit overwhelming. So, hey, why don't you just stop reading now and go play a game and then come back and read the rest.
Yeah, go play another game, yeah.
Yeah, it does some things really well, such as presenting examples. I mean, this seems like a very 90s, early 90s kind of thing. Just be really ambitious and try all these crazy things.
Right.
So it also, for me, has a place in history.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why didn't those make our top five? Couldn't we just make that the top five? Dungeons & Dragons, Vampire, Fate, Apocalypse World, and then Torg. Because I don't think either of us are going to budge on our chosen systems. So this is a happy and cop-out compromise.
Yeah, and... Yeah, I'm willing to compromise, of course, certain things. Like, again, I mentioned about like a classic point buy, I think, is absent from our list.
Right.
And I mentioned about like DC Heroes, a true universal system that's really mechanical, you know, more in the hero GURPS. Basic role-playing is absent.
To talk about the point buy, I mean, technically kind of Vampire is point buy. I mean, they're dots, but I mean, you are spending...
We called it the hybrid, the point by hybrid. Yeah. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, especially if you use kind of like Dungeons and Dragons and or Pathfinder as the classic class and level system. Well, you know, yeah, World of Darkness and Vampire are not that.
And if one thing's gone out of style in gaming, it is math. So, and I know I'm going to regret that example. What else would be people surprised didn't make the list?
Another game that didn't make the list was Savage Worlds, which I'm sure Chris would put forward if he were here, which is why we chose to do this episode without him, because I do not want that on the list.
Absolutely.
But we'll still give Chris the last word to sign us off. Take it away, Chris.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereedhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com.
Thanks a lot, and bye.
Bye.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.